and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on this program, I'm going to talk about the confrontation between the British Empire and the Portuguese Empire. On earlier programs, I've been talking about Portugal and the Portuguese Empire, and especially after the days of Napoleon. And one of the things that the British decided kind of unilaterally to do at that point was to prohibit slave trafficking. Now, the South Atlantic for 3.5 centuries had been the slave ocean. Millions and millions of slaves from Africa to the plantation areas in Brazil, in the Caribbean, in North America. And the British, the industry in Britain, especially the textile industry, was benefiting mightily from that. However, at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, there was an increasing movement for the abolition of slavery. And so, even though it was against the best economic interests of Britain, they decided that enough was enough. Of course, there are economic historians and political historians who believe that altruistic action among states and empires simply doesn't exist. Everything is a pretext for something unconfessable, much more oriented toward the bottom line, toward where the money is and where it's going. And so there are economic historians and political historians who say that Britain was doing this because it had decided that it no longer needed slaves, but that its commercial rivals still did. And certainly, at the time, this is what the French were saying. This is what the people in the United States who believed so much in slavery were saying. The United States at this time also had a kind of parallel abolitionist movement. But there was so much money to be made from slavery at this time, and from the increasing use of cotton, and the idea that the entire economy of the United States very, very soon was going to be based on cotton, and millions of slaves mobilized, sent south from areas closer to the coast, like Virginia or Tennessee, that had been producing tobacco, but the land was now exhausted. And you had the prospect of all of these hundreds, thousands of slaves with very little to do. However, cotton changed all of that. And somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million people were sent south to work on the new cotton plantations in the Mississippi River Basin, so that all of a sudden the money was all in the South. The money was all in cotton, and the entire basis of the economy of the United States shifted radically. And you didn't want anyone to call that into question. The money was much too good, so that the abolitionists were systematically silenced. There were all kinds of prohibitions against talking about the subject. Places where abolitionism was strong, the old, for example, the old Pilgrim and Puritan colonies, Massachusetts, New England, they found themselves sort of talking to each other, unable to engage in a national dialogue because, in large part, of this censorship. And interestingly, the financial capital of the American South at this time was paradoxically, New York City. All of the money was going to New York City. All of the money was coming from New York City. Cities in the South, like New Orleans in Louisiana or Atlanta in Georgia, they just didn't carry any financial weight. It wasn't where the bankers were. It wasn't where the money was. It wasn't where the money was going or coming from. As I say, all of the deals, all of the international shipping, all of the trade with textile mills in Manchester, all of that was done through New York. And so New York didn't want to hear about abolitionism either, right? Anything that would destroy such a lucrative system was considered intolerable in the United States, or rather in the places of the United States that benefited from this. As I say, the South and New York City. But here the British, who were benefiting mightily from this idea of King Cotton, had prohibited slavery in their colonies in the Caribbean and so forth, little by little. What they did was to pay the slave owners for their loss of capital. All of these human beings were priced as assets, and the owner was compensated for the loss of these assets. And this was done at a rate considered satisfactory by everyone. It wasn't cheap. It cost England lots and lots of money. The English taxpayer gave that money to slave owners who were already rich. Now, as part of this abolitionist program, England sent part of its navy down to West Africa. There on the coast, in very, very unsanitary conditions. You can imagine the sailors chosen for this task were not very happy about it, because it was, well, it increased the probability of getting ill. The mortality rate on those ships was high. But yes, they tried to form a blockade. And yet, they were not very effective. In the 19th century, there were two places that needed slaves a lot. Cuba, which was Spain's last point of contact in America, Cuba and Puerto Rico, needed to radically reorient their economies toward productivity, which meant toward plantations and the use of slaves. So Cuba, and then, of course, Brazil in the South Atlantic. In the late 1830s, more than 130,000 slaves arrived illicitly, right? Clandestinely. And the idea existed that, for further expansion by the British into the Pacific, that maybe South America, Rio de Janeiro in particular, maybe that could be a staging point for all of the maritime traffic going to India. So instead of going around the Cape of Good Hope, they could go around Cape Horn. And of course, more and more people were going around Cape Horn. Everybody wanted to go around Cape Horn when gold was discovered in California. In 1848, just at the end of the Mexican-American War, as we call it, when the size of Mexico was reduced by over 50%, and Mexico lost California, actually 2 weeks before the end of that conflict, gold was discovered in California, and the result was a gold rush. And suddenly everyone wanted to come to California, and everyone coming from Europe was going around Cape Horn. Now, the creation of the Suez Canal all of a sudden made it more interesting to go through the Mediterranean than down into the Red Sea. And so, in the late 19th century, all of the India traffic was doing that. That meant many things. It meant that, for example, Bombay instead of Calcutta was going to be the first port of call. It was going to be the gateway to India. And so this is when Bombay became prominent. The money was in Calcutta. It continued to be in Calcutta, but the west coast of India, now the point of contact and the point of export to Europe, was going to be much more prominent than the east coast, the Bay of Bengal. And Calcutta, as I say, where the Western money was and where they were busy growing opium for clandestine export into China. The only way to pay for Chinese tea was to smuggle, contrabandear, to smuggle opium from Bengal into the port around Canton. And of course, all of this was done by agencies and third parties and things. It wasn't done by the British Navy itself. It was all como negable, no? Deniable. You could always deny responsibility. But of course, this is what led to the Opium Wars and the Boxer Rebellion. Although it's right. We know a lot about martial arts today. We know a lot about Kung Fu. We know about warriors from Shaolin, different styles and different schools of Asian martial arts. And so from that perspective, from our sophistication, it sounds so strange to hear these people referred to as boxeadores, as boxers. But that's exactly what was happening. It was a spiritual movement, but the spirituality to be found through corporal disciplines such as martial arts. You could call it a warrior spirituality. But yes, at the time, just sort of denigrated by calling these people boxers, as if they were ruffians and pugilists. But meanwhile, back in the Atlantic, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil's capital, and at least initially capital of Portugal as well. In fact, briefly the only European country ever to have its capital in America, with a harbor that was so easy to enter that that you don't need a pilot, right? Normally, when you enter a harbor, you call for a local who knows how to get into the harbor, and this local, with the guide of ships, you know, to push and to turn and, you know, remolcar, to tow, will be able to negotiate the entry into the harbor. Well, the harbor in Rio de Janeiro was so incredible that a pilot wasn't necessary. And, well, because it was a place of refuge, because it had been transformed into a city, because with the arrival of the royal family, I mean, you couldn't have a place without a bank, you couldn't have a place without a university, you couldn't have a capital without a park or some kind of amenity. So, yeah, it was transformed, and between 1820 and 1849, the population more than doubled, so that by 1850, there were about 210,000 people living in Rio, and, of course, more than half of these were slaves. Toward the end of the century, Brazil, in addition to sugar, in addition to cotton, Brazil began to discover coffee. And at one point, more than half of Brazil's foreign trade was in coffee. This is at a time when in Europe, if you drank coffee, it was, in all probability, Brazilian coffee. Now, further down the coast, you had Argentina. Buenos Aires had more than doubled in population and was specializing in the export of meat, animal hides, and ganado, livestock in general. But in both these cities, both in Rio de Janeiro and in Buenos Aires, It was British merchants who controlled the export trade. And as I say, at least officially, the British were opposed to slavery, but the great market for slaves was Brazil. The British felt so strongly about this that they imposed a regime change in Lagos, Nigeria, what had been called until that time the Slave Coast. And, well, this caused a series of wars in Benin and around West Africa generally. Now, for the Portuguese, Angola, you have to recognize that this is the main source of wealth. Export of slaves is where they get their money. If they can't export slaves, they won't have any money. Lisbon cannot accede to complete ban, can't agree to a total prohibition, because inevitably that would throw Angola in with Brazil. Angola could just switch its loyalty from Portugal to Brazil. So you would have an exporting country and an importing country that simply gets rid of the intermediary, right? You cut out the middleman and business gets better. But as I say, in Nigeria, first there was a ban, and then 10 years later, in the middle of the 19th century, they just took over. They annexation, and, well, the Portuguese actually thought what the British intended to do was to convert that part of West Africa into a second Brazil with a plantation economy using slave labor. But as I say, the abolitionists formed a very powerful lobby with a strong moral argument back in Britain. And, well, in the end, British warships went directly to Brazil. They entered into Brazil's harbors in 1850, 1851, and captured or began to sink any ships that carried slaves or that were equipped for the transport of slaves across the Atlantic. And as I said, all of this was very good propaganda back home. But in, as I said, both in Brazil and in Cuba as well, slavery went on for another generation. In Brazil, it survived until 1888. But that didn't prevent the British from intervening in South America pretty much any time. Like they felt they needed to. There was a time when Argentina wanted to annex Uruguay back in 1830, and that didn't happen because of British intervention. The British and the French got together in a blockade, forcing Buenos Aires to stop its attempt to annex the Paraná River and make that part of northern Argentina. And that just started a series of conflicts between Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina, and then little Paraguay, who couldn't defend itself, and Paraguay sort of lost. It was devastated. It was ruined. Genetically, the people in Paraguay, in their matrilineal line, they go back a long way. But in the patrilineal line, it turns out that sometime in the late 19th century, say between 1865 and 1870, practically all the men were killed. The women were left alive, but all of the men were killed. And their descendants are the descendants of the men who replaced them. But, getting back to Portugal and Portugal's plans for Africa, because remember that they were there for 500 years. To understand Portugal, you have to understand Africa and vice versa. This is closer than a marriage. And as I mentioned in an earlier program, when Brazil finally opted for independence, Portugal doubled down on its colonies in Africa. Remember that those colonies in Asia, except for, say, Goa, Macau, those colonies had been taken over by the Dutch. I talked about that on an earlier program. But during the time of Napoleon, after Napoleon took over the Netherlands, the English turned around and took over the Dutch colonies. Now, Holland, after the Napoleonic War, they got back Batavia on the island of Java, what today we call Jakarta, and that was given back to the Dutch. But other places considered of great strategic value simply were not. I mean, Ceylon, what today we call Sri Lanka. Ceylon, I mean, if you talk about the Indian Ocean as a kind of a, como una bisagra, no, as a hinge between the Arab seas on the western part and the Bay of Bengal, and then all of the access into Southeast Asia and the eastern part, well, Ceylon is right there. It had been Portuguese, then it was Dutch, then it was English. The Cape of Good Hope, separating the Atlantic and the Indian Oceans, of enormous strategic value. First it was Portuguese, then it was Dutch, and now, after the Napoleonic War, it was English. And even more than the strategic value of these, toward the late 19th century, there was a series of financial crises. You know, it took an enormous amount of money and an enormous amount of tolerance for risk to build railroads. However, at that point, everybody understood that railroads were the future. And you began to build railroads everywhere. Europe was thick with railroads. The United States had a novel solution. They allowed the people funding the railroads to have free land on either side of the railroad. And so this more than compensated the actual building program. I mean, you could develop this land, and these were going to be the great fortunes of the future. California, where I'm from, in the late 19th century, was controlled by four railroad multimillionaires. But what happens when the railroads don't work? What happens when, you know, financially they collapse? Because not everybody has the luxury, like in the United States, of treating land as if it were terra nullius, as if it didn't belong to anyone. No, everywhere else, this land has to be expropriated for the public good and can't simply be given to the people financing the railroad. No, in other places, you really have to have state intervention. But as I say, anything can go wrong. And many, many things did go wrong with this initial industrialization through railroads. Okay, I have to take a short break now. I'll be back in just a minute.
For Teens.
¿Y de qué se trata eso?
Es un programa intensivo de inglés que dura una semana aquí en Madrid en un colegio mayor y son clases y actividades muy chulas. Año tras año. Hay niños que repiten, chicos, chavales, vienen cansados, agotados, ahora que notan el empujón que se le da al inglés, de verdad. Y lo más importante es que vienen con ganas de seguir aprendiendo, motivados, y eso es lo más importante.
Una pregunta que se hará la gente que nos está escuchando, por ejemplo, que nos está escuchando fuera de Madrid. Uh-huh. ¿Algún día se hará esto de los VIP en otras zonas?
¿En otras zonas de España?
Lo dejamos ahí, que puede ser.
Sí.
Todo llega.
Todo llegará. Viene gente de toda España, ¿eh? Vienen participantes,
sí, también es
de toda
verdad,
España.
Pero bueno, hay gente que no quiere moverse mucho de su zona,
sí.
Y bueno, teniendo más oportunidades de hacerlo
más cerca.
Más cerca,
bueno,
de su delegación.
Desplazarse, sí.
¿Hay un sitio donde pueden informarse? ¿Una web?
Pues lo mejor es llamarnos.
Es llamar siempre,
sí,
siempre.
Lo mejor es llamarnos.
No pueden llamar para tratar lo que queráis. Sobre todo si preguntáis por los campamentos, que es el 911335832.
Sí.
Ahora dilo tú.
91, lo mejor es llamarnos, ¿o qué? Un número. A ver, 911335832. Y ahí ya les damos información de primera mano.
Nos quedan poquitas plazas, ¿eh? Siempre lo decimos, no es mentira, es que como lo vamos dejando todo para el último momento, pues luego pasa lo que pasa. Puedes llamarnos al 911335832 y ahí nuestros maravillosos compañeros van a informarte de todo lo relacionado con los campamentos. Nunca me cansaré de decir el teléfono. ¿Queréis decirlo vosotros? La última oportunidad.
Vale, 911335832.
Hasta luego.
Si tienes un smartphone o una tablet, no tienes excusas. Descarga ya nuestra app de Vaughan Radio y podrás escuchar nuestra radio en directo, enviarnos tus tweets, conocer nuestra parrilla, acceder a nuestros podcasts y enterarte de todas las novedades de Vaughan. Aprende inglés en cualquier momento y en cualquier lugar con la app de Vaughan Radio.
¿Cómo tú ves tanta pasión en lo que hacen, tanta dedicación? Porque luego tienes a lo largo del máster, tienes feedbacks con ellos. Y ellos te dicen exactamente cuáles son tus puntos débiles, cuáles son tus fortalezas, cuáles son tus weaknesses, debilidades, ¿no? ¿Sabes? Y cuando ves a alguien que hace con tanta pasión algo, no te viene tan natural decepcionarle. Porque si tú ves a alguien que da el 100%, a mí por lo menos no me viene como decepcionarte así. Es una cuestión de respeto que luego se desarrolla y se ve también con los compañeros. Cuando, sobre todo, en un método tan dinámico, tan drilling class, pam, 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 maravilloso.
La motivación desde el primer minuto hasta el último es un factor importante, pero no el único. La excelencia de nuestros profesores, nuestros maestros de toda la vida, esos que hacían que el resto de tu vida sintieses verdadera pasión por aquella asignatura. Así son nuestros profesores del Máster en Inglés Profesional. ¿Por qué no llamas? ¿Vas a perder esta oportunidad? 911-33-5833. 911-33-5833. Llama y solicita gratis tu prueba de nivel. 911-33-5833.
¿Te sientes orgulloso de ti mismo? Porque tú lo puedes hacer.
Con el Máster en Inglés Profesional puedes conseguir lo que quieras. Tú lo puedes hacer. Imagina poder comunicarte con total soltura, sin miedos, con confianza. La barrera psicológica la romperás definitivamente en tan solo 6 días.
Manda a Vaughan Town a un amigo empleado que esté desesperado con el inglés y obsérvale 6 días después. El cambio que verás te sorprenderá. La inversión en tiempo y dinero tendrá un retorno impresionante.
Allí, entre angloparlantes de los más variopintos, avanzarás 1000 kilómetros en confianza, convicción y aplomo. Dominarás sus entornos de comunicación a pesar de un dominio aparentemente imperfecto del inglés. Ni 6 meses en el extranjero da lo que 6 días dan en Vaughan Town.
Me apunté al curso trimestral porque quería mejorar el inglés, lo que pasa que no estaba muy convencido porque no tenía muy claro si iba a ser una clase pues aburrida y monótona que hemos tenido siempre pues en el instituto, que al final no te motiva nada, pero el primer día que nos metimos ahí y el profesor nos empezó a meter caña, pues vi que eso pues no iba a ser para nada monótono.
Cursos trimestrales de Vaughan, 911-33-5833 o grupovaughan.com.
Si te acabas de licenciar, no entres en el mercado laboral ni te plantees un máster hasta no resolver del todo la cuestión del inglés. Resuelve el tema ahora, mientras eres joven y tienes tiempo. Después, es casi imposible. Y recuerda, para los reclutadores vale más un probado dominio del inglés que una docena de másters.
Resuélvelo ya. Llámanos 91-133-5833. 91-133-5833. Recuerda hacer tu prueba de nivel sin compromiso. Llámanos 91-133-5833. Y ahora financiate el 100% del máster. Consulta condiciones en grupobaugan.com.
Aquí llega Lorena Martínez con la última pregunta del examen. Vaya, parece que le ha caído el pass perfect. Lorena lleva toda la temporada entrenando el pass perfect, pero nunca ha sido su punto fuerte. ¡Wow! Eso es Lorena. Vamos, vamos. Fill the gap, Lorena. ¡Wow! Increíble. Has acertado todas, todas. ¡Qué barbaridad! Lorena Martínez, señoras y señores, qué crack. El examen es de 10.
Consigue que tus hijos sean unos auténticos cracks del inglés con los cursos del Club Junior. No solo mejorarán sus notas, sino que hablarán inglés de verdad y serán capaces de comunicarse. Y por si eso fuera poco, lo pasan genial en clase. Club Junior son las clases para niños de 4 a 17 años en grupos muy reducidos y 100% método Vaughan. Infórmate ya en el 911-335-832, 911-335-832 o en grupovaughan.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on the first part of the program, I was talking about the situation, the political, economic situation, the strategic situation, especially in the Atlantic, the South Atlantic, and how all of this is going to impact on Portugal. As I say, Portugal begins to focus on its African colonies. And toward the end of the century, everybody is focusing on colonies, in part because of continuous financial crises related to industrialization and especially the building of the railroads. In the United States, it's railroad. In England, it is railway. And I will use either term interchangeably. Now, so much depends on whether a railroad is profitable or not. When it decides, well, when banks, generally financial institutions, decide that it is not giving the kind of returns they expected, quite often this starts an irrational panic. One of the things that, unfortunately, capitalism was responsible for in this industrialization was senseless duplication of lines. So, for example, everybody knows that the first railroad to get from point A to point B is going to make a lot of money. All of a sudden, you have three people trying to be the first to build a railroad from point A to point B. The rational thing would be to discuss it among themselves and sort of share. And everyone would benefit if somebody intervened, but that was not the capitalist way. This is why, for example, today when you go to New York City, you have subway lines that are parallel to each other. It is the most stupid, the most ridiculous thing you can possibly imagine to have these subway lines in parallel, north and south, on the east side, on the west side, and
If you want to go cross town, you're stuck. You have to take a bus or walk if you can, or a taxi, especially at night. In any case, this is the sort of thing that drives these companies into bankruptcy and with a cascade effect, so that the company goes into bankruptcy, the institution that finances the company goes into bankruptcy. Banks in that area of the country are suddenly perceived as weak and vulnerable. And so all of the depositors ask for their money. And there is what we call a run on the bank, a complete loss of faith in the institution. And then you have a series of bankruptcies, and this degenerates into a crisis. And in an increasingly globalized world, a crisis in one country provokes a crisis in the rest of the world. So that a spectacular bank failure in, say, Argentina is very bad news in London, and worse news for the affiliate banks in New York, Calcutta, Hong Kong. And especially from the financial crisis of 1870, things didn't get much better until way into the 1880s. Well, the lesson that people were able to draw, no, sacar, you think that draw means dibujar, but no, draw means tirar de algo, así que to draw a lesson. The lesson that people were able to draw from this strategically is that colonies are necessary. Colonization is necessary. And the advanced economies of Europe need as much of the world as they possibly can as captive markets to insulate themselves, to isolate themselves from the shocks, from the possible consequences, the damage they could suffer because of an excess of exposure. It's very curious that today, after, you know, what was happening during COVID and suspicion about China's future and the state of the Chinese economy, and, well, all sorts of things. The idea that the economic connections between Western Europe and Russia were not such a good idea. You know, this idea that economic integration means that the cost of destroying things is much too great. It's a disincentive to, say, aggression. But of course, if you look at history, there was no more, say, integrated economy than in Yugoslavia. Marshal Tito wanted to make sure that there was no fragmentation in Yugoslavia, and so that each and every economy there was completely dependent on other places in the country. And these economic ties were so strong that Tito and his advisors and the international economic community, everybody who looked on at this, thought that these chains that connected Yugoslavia were unbreakable. But that's not the way things happened. And it was much the same idea of engaging first with the Soviet Union, then with Russia. And of course, deeply, deeply engaging with China, thinking that globalization is a one-way road. But now we're talking about deglobalization. Now we're talking about, just in case, maybe it's better to have domestic industry and not be so dependent. And this is the new story being sold to the world as basic prudence. Maybe we were wrong to be so globalized. Well, believe it or not, this is exactly the same message that people received after the Great Crisis in 1870, that you need domestic suppliers, you need a domestic market, but the lesson was what you really need are colonies.
large colonies producing prime materials, large colonies as captive markets, large colonies as your insurance policy in case there is disruption in the world financial system. And so you had England, France, very interested in expansion, consolidation, Germany as soon as it could, trying to create a global system of colonies. Spain moving into North Africa, the United States thinking seriously about Cuba and the Philippines, in addition to, say, Hawaii. And all of this with the idea of not just staying on the coast, but going inward. Certainly in Mozambique, very much like Angola, Portugal's presence was mostly in coastal enclaves, but they wanted more. As I say, this is a time when people believe that the future is your colonies. The future is developing your presence in these underdeveloped countries. And the Portuguese idea was to begin to establish a connection, trading posts, colonization, plantations, villages, connecting the west coast of Africa to the east coast of Africa, connecting Angola to Mozambique. And this would involve moving into Bechuana land, what is today Botswana, moving around the Zambezi River, moving in places that really had not been explored. What today is Zimbabwe, what today is Malawi. However, they came up against Cecil Rhodes. Now, Cecil Rhodes, I'll be talking more about Cecil Rhodes. I'll be talking more about the British Empire, right? Because I have been talking about different empires. Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, a little about the French, a little about the German. But the elephant in the room is the British Empire. And so, in a couple of weeks, I will begin with what was the British Empire? What was the nature of the British Empire? But just for now, the British Empire is going to come face to face with the Portuguese Empire, and one of the two is going to have to echarse para atrás, no? They're back down. One of the two is going to have to back down. Let's talk about Cecil Rhodes. He left school at age 17. In other words, did not have a formal education, missed that all his life, made sure that later in life he was self-educated, but always placed an enormous value on education and on what he had been forced by circumstances to give up, or in his case, to postpone. That is why when he did become one of the richest people in the world, part of that money went to education. In any case, yes, he did give up school, and he went to join his brother in South Africa, in the Natal area. Remember that after the Portuguese rounded the Cape of Good Hope, I believe this was the very first voyage, I believe this was Vasco da Gama, and they hated the Cape. They called it the Cape of Storms. And once they were safe on the other side, it was Christmas time. And they celebrated in a big way and called the whole area Natal. So this is the Natal area of South Africa. At the time, as I mentioned on an earlier program, the big thing was cotton. Cotton for textile mills, cotton for export to Manchester or Liverpool. But, you know, there's always transportation costs. India produces a lot of cotton, but it isn't cheap to get that cotton to the coast. Whereas America, the United States, had the enormous advantage of the Mississippi River, fluvial transportation, the cheapest in the world. Now, the combination of that and free land, after the Indians had been expelled, free land and slave labor from Africa, nobody could beat those prices, right? It was very, very difficult. Even after the American Civil War, even after the abolition of slavery in the United States, those American prices were still unbeatable. So people could understand that there wasn't that much of a future for cotton in South Africa. It couldn't compete. I mean, if you wanted good cotton, go to Egypt. In Egypt, you have semi-slave labor and lots and lots of the best farmland that belongs to the Sultan. And there is no better cotton than Egyptian cotton. Plus, you have fluvial transportation in the form of the Nile River. This is in the Nile Delta. And, yeah, Rhodes can't compete with that either. So he went into diamonds. And so by the age of 20, he was rich. By the end of his 20s, he was unbelievably rich and could afford to educate himself. The oldest person in his class in Oxford, and at that point forming the British South Africa Company. The future of the British South Africa Company is along the Zambezi River, and this is precisely where Portugal wants to connect Angola and Mozambique. So immediately he creates militias of tribes, right, local tribesmen, and sends them to attack the Portuguese, sort of mercenaries. But again, with this deniability, you can always say that you didn't do it, no. And you don't know who did it, but all you know is that it was done. And then, this was very important for the British Empire at this time, the end of the 19th century, there was a very, very strange transformation in the British Empire at the end of the 19th century. All of a sudden, they found religion. All of a sudden, there were missionaries, Anglican missions everywhere. Instead of exploiting, instead of command, instead of management, instead of administration, instead of development, and instead of cooperation and forming allegiances. No, the idea was to transform the savage and to bring culture into the darkness in the form of the Anglican Church, well, and other Protestant denominations. And this made it a perfect tool for manipulation in terms of propaganda. Because after centuries of exclusion, systematic exclusion, legal apartheid in England, in Britain in general, against Catholics, so that Catholics were legally second-class citizens for hundreds of years. All of that in the late 19th century was being undone. People were worried about the consequences and worried about, you know, whether this would in fact undermine, socavar, undermine the established church. So here you could talk about a kind of a war between Protestant missionaries and Catholics and almost 400 years of Catholicism on the part of the Portuguese. And all of this historical stigma attached to the Leyenda Negra, which affected Portugal in addition to Spain. And what about the safety, the physical integrity of missionaries? Missionaries in South Africa, missionaries on the frontier, the northern frontier, missionaries along the Zambezi. You had celebrity missionaries like David Livingstone, Livingstone who had no vocation for being a missionary, who supposedly was, you know, he was supposed to represent the church, but he had no interest in staying in one place very long. He was very interested in being, you know, the first European to go from one place in Africa to another place in Africa. And along the way, if he had to do things that were not Christian, he was fine with that too. But he wrote a lot. He gave good interviews. And so everybody knew his name. And Livingstone, talking about future colonies on the Zambezi. and how the plains in what is today Zambia are a kind of earthly paradise. And little by little, you know, they certainly won the propaganda war at home. There was definite pressure in London for the government to assert itself. Rhodes going on record as saying that Portuguese are lazy, incompetent, half-caste, which is, of course, mulatto or mestizo, but with a very bad connotation, as if we were talking about contaminated blood. So yes, a lazy, incompetent, half-caste race of bastards. And he went on record saying this about the Portuguese. Now, his idea was to connect Cairo to Cape Town by rail, when in fact nobody knew. You know, people were treating Africa as if it were a country, not a continent. And this was in a time when much of that land was unexplored. But yes, specifically talking about what was happening in Africa at this time, I forget who it was that said, men sitting in their luxurious offices in Europe should be prohibited from spending too much time looking at maps. But whatever the reason, this idea prevailed, and London responded. On June 1st, 1890, the British ambassador to Lisbon gave the foreign minister an ultimatum, saying that if Portugal did not immediately abandon any plan to make a coast-to-coast connection through Africa, the immediate result would be war, right? Playing the trump card immediately, right? Un órdago. No finesse, no subtlety, no nuance, no diplomacy. And you can imagine the Portuguese reaction. First of all, the hurt and the decepción, the disappointment, the severe disappointment, because the Portuguese-English alliance had been in place for many centuries, and it had become so easy over the years to become sentimental about that alliance. But, well, on a second level, this hurts their pride. And so, yes, they are going to turn against Britain, turn against British interests. But at the same time, the British are so deeply integrated into the Portuguese economy. And then, of course, when it turns out that the foreign minister and the prime minister decided that they had no choice but to say yes unconditionally to whatever the British were demanding, that anger turned against the government as well. The government had no choice. It dissolved. The people involved in making this decision had to leave the country, and the king appointed a man named Franco, João Franco, as dictator. The police, military, they were called in to attack the rioters, who were in turn so busy simply trying to demonstrate their patriotism. Meanwhile, all newspapers were closed and complete censorship was imposed. And the king, this is Carlos I, right, the one who paints watercolors, aquarelas, and the one who really doesn't want to worry about the country so much, but who loves dressing up in uniforms and always wants to be seen as being an integral part of the armed forces, almost like a little boy, the warrior king. Well, he abandons Lisbon goes into hiding, I suppose, back in the Braganza family estate there in Vila Viçosa, just a few kilometers from Extremadura, just a few kilometers from the Spanish border, just in case anything happens. And
this situation continued. There was a dictatorship for the longest time. Franco was able to expel anybody he wanted, was able to banish, right, desterrar anyone he wanted from the country without trial. He was given that power. This is something the Portuguese have not forgotten. Even today, you can ask them about this incident, and they may have forgiven the English, but they certainly haven't forgotten what the English did. Okay, I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please, listen to my next program.
Escúchanos en cualquier momento y en cualquier lugar. Descarga la app de Baugan Radio.
¿Crees que tienes un buen nivel de inglés? Vete a Baugan Town y date cuenta, nada más llegar, de que tu dominio es más cercano al cero absoluto. En inglés decimos humble pie, o sea, comer tarta de humildad. Baugan Town te dará primero un rudo despertar, y conforme pasan los días, un nuevo despertar. Un despertar lleno de seguridad, confianza y convicción. Si existen los milagros, Bowentown se cuenta entre ellos.
Many English methods guarantee that you can learn English with 20 minutes a day. Don't believe them. The only guarantee in these cases is that your money will be in their pocket.